It's Saturday, February 21st. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio as a regular geek is Ben Jaffe. Ben is a teacher, traveler, and music geek. Hey.
Good morning.
We also have back in the studios after a bit of a hiatus, Alan Luckow. He's an The area man, if you will.
Oh,
local area man.
There you are.
It's a new media time. Architect. Yep. Al's a designer extraordinaire for many years with many different companies. You've probably seen his logos and work, and you don't even know it. And Al, welcome to the studio.
Hello, everybody.
Ben, as I said at the start of the show, it's February 21st. Can you tell us some current affairs dates, please?
Yes, I can tell you two anniversaries, which are important to me because I like space stuff. So, first of all, we've got, I have an article by the Bad Astronomer, who is actually
awesome.
A very good astronomer named Phil Plate, and he has a fantastic blog, and it's entitled 5 Years of Staring into the Sun, and it's talking about the Solar Dynamics Observatory, NASA Solar Dynamics Observatory.
Please, public service, don't stare at the sun.
Don't do that unless you're
just the title.
A robot
like
or a
satellite. 1 hour Martinizing. It's more than 1 hour.
Unless you're a really bad astronomer, then yeah. You can stare at the sun.
Right. But apparently, and we don't know this because we humans don't physically stare into the sun a bunch, but it's really beautiful. There's a lot of incredible things. And
I can't express, this enough. Don't stare,
don't
at, the
stare at the sun. So instead, go to geekspeak.org and click on the link to this article, and it's got many pretty pictures and links to things.
And this is 5 years of basically solar discoveries.
5 years.
Yeah, cool.
And then half an order of magnitude more, 25 years. It's the 25-year anniversary from the Voyager 1 spacecraft taking... you guys have probably seen this photo. It's this photo of basically a black field, and there's some light beams kind of going across it, and there's one little pixel.
A blue one?
That's a pale blue dot, that is Earth. Hmm. And basically, Carl Sagan, back 25 years ago, managed to convince the Voyager 1 spacecraft engineers to turn it around. It wasn't meant to take a picture of the Earth, but he managed to convince them to turn it around and snap a picture from over 6 billion kilometers away, and we've got this image. And actually, I want to read my favorite quote, I think, of all time from Carl Sagan. And he wrote in 1994 in his book Pale Blue Dot, "From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest, but for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, on that dot, everything you love, everything you know, everything you ever heard of, every human being, whoever it was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam."
Nice.
I love that quote.
Mm-hmm. So that picture was taken 25 years ago.
25 years ago, 6 billion kilometers away, and we're one little pixel.
Yeah.
And that's everything.
How deep and meaningful. Thank you.
It's amazing. It's profound.
Let's completely switch that to robots eating people.
What? Al?
Yeah. I don't know.
It's a change of pace.
Definitely.
It is a little bit of a change of pace. But again, it sort of deals with humanity and how I've always said it's just a matter of time before robots rise up.
Yeah.
And then we have to bow to these overlords. And I believe it has begun.
You are a bit of a conspiracy theorist on this, though.
Just you know what? I'm just reporting the facts here.
Okay.
This happened in Korea. A 52-year-old South Korean woman was attacked by a robot vacuum. And I don't know if you've seen this. It's news. She was on the floor sleeping, which is when they are, I mean, you've got to be aware.
Robots don't sleep.
Yes, they don't sleep.
They take advantage of that.
And she had her Roomba-like robot vacuum cleaning the house because, you know, it's serving her. Well, she has long hair, and she was laying on the floor. And I don't know. I don't know how she can sleep through one of these things on, because I have one. And anyway, she's on the floor sleeping. Thing comes up to her, grabs her hair, and sucks it up into the, you know, the mechanism. And the woman's trapped. She starts screaming, doesn't know what to do. Her hair is caught in this thing, and they're pretty heavy. And before it was able to actually devour her, she was able to call the equivalent of 911 in Korea. I think it's like 119 or there's a – it's very similar. She calls that, and the emergency people come, and, you know, one of them snaps a picture. Which, this isn't funny, people. Anyway.
Oh, come on. It is a Roomba, right? It looks like a Roomba.
It looks like a Roomba. Okay. And so one of them snaps a picture, and we have this.
Wait, so she had her phone on her to call 911?
Yeah, apparently she's prepared. Yeah. And they're there. They've got their face masks on, and they're removing the robot. It doesn't look like it's resisting. And they did get it off. Just saying, you know, this is happening. And the other thing I want to mention, very quickly, the Roomba people chimed in and wanted to say the robotic vacuum cleaner that got tangled in the hair of a woman from Changwon, South Korea, is not an iRobot product.
It's not made by the Roomba company.
You know, because everybody's going to look and go, oh, it's a Roomba. Yeah. You know, it's like Kleenex, you know, but right. It's not a – I actually have a Roomba.
I like that in their quote. They don't say that could happen. Yeah. They don't say, oh, that couldn't happen. They're like, no, just that doesn't happen to be ours.
It's a pretty miraculous device. I was very skeptical.
Do you like the Roomba?
I was the last person to buy one, I think.
Don't have one. Well, so you might lose your title to me soon.
People have like said they're good, and I'm like, how good can this? It's not a big thing. It can't not a big receptacle. It can't hold much, and how, you know, it's just. But you know, I got to tell you, they're really well done. The technology is there. They've got HEPA filters. You run the thing. It's got a scheduler. You know, it's like cleans your house,
and it does like a strange pattern. Right? It just kind of starts doing its thing and kind of roams the room, and slightly algorithmically, but not that intelligent, right?
My wife has watched the Roomba trying to figure out its pattern and has declared that it's not
sentient.
There's no way that this is, but it is an algorithm, and it does do a really good job, but it doesn't do it like evenly, like in lines or anything. Right. So you're like, how did it clean
this? I saw a time lapse of it once, and it just kind of randomly goes in circles, and it looks like it's doing something at any given point in time, but I don't think there's any kind of method to its madness. Yeah.
Well, it's hard to find patterns in movement like that, right? Even if the algorithm is relatively simple, it is hard to determine what that algorithm is by looking at it.
But you can but you can't see patterns if it's time lapse. So
you'd want to see like 40 runs of the same robot in the same room and see what happens. Mm-hmm. Like whether it grows over time and learns the room better, probably not.
When they run out of battery, when they're getting close, they remember where their base is and they drive back to the base and charge themselves.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I mean, this one was clearly smart enough to decide it had an enemy and
just don't fall asleep. Yeah. Well,
asleep on the
push
floor.
The power button on the robot before you fall asleep.
At this point, the safety tip is don't fall asleep, but pretty soon it's going to be don't blink.
Yes. So speaking of pattern matching.
Terrifying. Ben. Speaking of finding human subjects, well, a lot of us as children were always looking for this one person. Two particular people. Carmen Sandiego is one of them. And Waldo was the other one.
Ah, yes.
So for those
the
of you who
don't striped
know,
man, yes.
Yeah, for like the three people who don't know,
Waldo, who's that?
There's a series of children's books by this illustrator named Martin Handford, and they got really popular, at least in the United States. And they're called Where's Waldo? And they're just these double page spread illustrations with dozens or hundreds of people. And one of them is Waldo, and Waldo's always wearing a Waldo shirt. It's a little striped white and red shirt. So children all around the world are always trying to find Waldo. Some guy found there was a Slate article claiming that they found a strategy for finding Waldo in the books. And of course, because it's a Slate article, they were just making random stuff up. It's not.
Wow, that's pretty attacking of Slate.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, it wasn't a profound statistical analysis of the distribution.
It was like look one area, then move.
No,
then
it was
look
like, huh, if you plot it out, Waldo tends to be within these two bands. So just look in those two bands. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, like, the data set is not big enough to be able to say something.
You gave that
like
instruction
that.
To robots, and they wouldn't be able to take over the world. Like,
right.
You need
so,
more than that.
So I would read that Slate article and just be like, ugh, that's annoying. And I'd move on. Machine learning people are not like that, apparently. At least one of them wasn't. This one guy, Randy Olson, was like, you know, that's dumb. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to use all of my machine learning foo and try and find out what the actual optimal search strategy for finding Waldo would be. And here's a quote from his blog. But Randy, don't you have better things to work on? You know, curing cancer, solving world hunger, anything else a sane person would have said at that point. Too bad that sane person wasn't around. So
so what he did is he took like thousands of Waldo pictures and...
Well, first he did what's called a kernel density estimate. Don't ask me to explain how it works, which just basically takes all of the locations in all of the books across the two-page spread illustrations and does kind of an estimation, and you can kind of see visually.
Up at geekspeak.org.
Yeah, if you look in the upper left, Waldo's never in the upper, almost never in the upper left.
It's
and
like
of course,
heat, it's like a heat map.
It's like a little heat map, right? Of course, the reason Waldo's not in the upper left is because there's always a little thing with a picture of Waldo being like, hey, try and find me. So there's something there, so Waldo was never there. Also, on the second page, in the bottom left of the second page, very rarely would you find Waldo there. So that's interesting enough. But in terms of computing the optimal search strategy, he put it through a series of genetic algorithms or a bunch of genetic algorithms and just kind of tweaked the parameters and let it run for 5 minutes and came up with a general solution. And I'm not going to try to explain.
But basically,
it
it's a path that you look for the image. You
it's
take your eyes
path.
And follow that path. And
yeah, you
you'll find them faster.
Start in the left page, bottom left, move a little to the right, move up, cross over to the second page, and then move down. And
I need this document so that next time I have a Where's Waldo, I'll be able to do it efficiently.
Right. So if you want the tips without looking at the picture, the bottom of the left page is a good place to start. The upper quarter of the right page is the next best place to look,
and
then the
bottom
right.
If you're curious about this, you really should go to our website and study this out. I mean, I think a 3-hour seminar on how to get this algorithm into your mind makes sense.
Yeah, I just want to read one more quote from
this.
Yeah,
please.
Quote, this was all done in good humor, and barring a situation where someone puts a gun to your head and forces you to find Waldo faster than your colleague, I don't actually recommend using this strategy for casual Where's Waldo reading. As with so many things in life that join, finding Waldo is in the journey, not the destination.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Ben, for the Waldo update.
I'm so happy to see machine learning being used in really productive and really funny ways.
Well, you know, that's how ideas are... You know, people come up with ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we laugh at it, but this is how the creative process works.
Hey, Al, can you give us a magic story?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not really a good magician.
Okay.
However, I will tell you about a website that if you're into magic, and who isn't? Quite frankly, who doesn't?
All geeks are into
somebody
magic.
Like. Oh, I don't like magic.
Right.
Come on. it's called Illusionist. And
with an E?
With an E. Illusionist.com. And this
domain
website...
Domain names are hard to find.
Yeah. It's like that new company, Thrithmithin.com. That's all that was available.
Lots of consonants.
Thrithmithin. Anyway, this site, it's kind of like if you've seen Linda... Linda's...
The educational site.
The educational
site.
With
videos to train you and stuff.
Yeah. And that one's with a Y.
Right. Where you pay for like these tutorials. This is like that, except in my opinion, it's done even better. And it's all magic tricks. And you can go in here and they have like a really well-presented catalog of magicians' tricks. And you can buy them by the trick. And, you know, they range...
Oh, and they give you the answer. They tell you how to do it.
Oh, yeah. They show you a video.
Cool.
You look at one, and maybe it's a card trick, and then it plays the video, and the guy shows you the trick, and it talks about it. And then you see it's like, oh, this is $7, or, you know, the good ones are like $50. And but, you know, then you own the trick, and you know how to do it. I mean, this is... And it looks to me like there's hundreds of them. Like, you can filter by subject.
Oh,
there's,
cool.
There's card slights, card tricks, presentations. representation, coin magic, flourishing, mentalism. There's a general category with just a miscellaneous. You can organize them by the highest, most expensive to the least expensive.
Are most of these card tricks or just general, just in general?
They're all different kinds. And mentalism is like being able to tell what you're thinking.
Are some of these, does the purchase, besides the knowledge, is all just you get the knowledge, or do you also get materials sometimes?
You
like
get,
if you're going to do fire tricks or something, you get the materials too, or just the knowledge?
No, you just get the knowledge.
And they
show you the video. So it's kind of like Linda,
cool.
You think about it, and it's like, yeah, that's, and they're actually, and they're not all the same person. It's like all these different people that
they
filter through, and it's kind of neat. People develop these tricks, and then it's a marketplace. But if I had this when I was a kid,
I know it.
I'd
be spending a lot of money on those. And of course, you can preview the magic trick first, see how cool it is, and then you can buy it and learn how to do it.
Right.
Awesome. Right. And you can learn more about that and everything we talk about up at geekspeak.org. And while you're online, take a look at us on Twitter. You can send us notes and ask us questions and stuff at Twitter. We're KOSP Geeks. You're listening to KOSP. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the studio is Alan Luckow and Ben Jaffe. Ben, how do dogs smell?
Heck if I know.
But I do...
I know what mine smells like.
It smells delicious.
Wet dog. Yeah, that's a smell.
Yeah.
I do have a charming video that, unfortunately, we haven't figured out how to deliver video content over radio yet. So
it's called television, Ben. We figured it out a long time ago.
Over radio, yeah. Oh, darn it.
Darn.
You got me there.
But in any case.
Anyway, so dogs are amazing. Their sense of smell is amazing. We all know that. We have 6 million sensory receptor sites in our noses. Dogs have 200 to 300 million.
Wow.
Which is a lot more, right? And there's a charming video on how they smell, both some of the mechanisms behind how their nose and that mechanism works, and also some fun facts and really cute animations.
Cool.
It was a TEDx talk by a cognitive science scientist, Alexandra Horowitz, and I highly recommend you go and watch this. It will make your day so much happier.
And our very efficient intern, Chandler, is currently putting that up on geekspeak.org, so you can visit geekspeak.org and see how dogs smell video. It should be fun.
And so
Speaking of cool videos.
We smell a pizza, and a dog smells, hey, I smell pepperoni and flour and sugar and salt and tomatoes and... lettuce or onions.
But of course, they don't think what those words are, right? They just know what they have.
They have different words for them.
Ah, okay.
They can actually sniff out skin, breast, bladder, and lung cancer with a decent degree of accuracy. Yes, in pizza.
I don't want that pizza.
No, not in pizza, in humans. But
wow.
It's
pretty amazing.
We can't even fathom what their world is like,
So speaking of cool videos to watch.
Yes. There's a website that I found that is just, if you like documentaries, and who doesn't, it's thousands of documentaries, all free. The documentaries, yes, they're all free. The documentaries themselves range in length, but, most of them are like an hour, some 2 hours. They're streaming. The site is called Documentary Addict, and they've got everything from, history, science, mystery, nature, conspiracy, health, drugs, religion, biography, everything in here. And I went through and I thought, well, how good? This is a bunch of junky YouTube thing. But they're actually all really nice HD videos. And there's no advertising. I don't really get how they're making any money on these things.
Are they hosted at the site, or are they hosted at other places? Are they linked to other places, or are they actually hosted there?
Well, the way that the buttons work is when you hit watch, it plays it within a frame.
It could be hosted somewhere else potentially.
I don't,
because the bandwidth cost on that would be pretty severe.
It looks like a YouTube play button, but
yes,
might be a YouTube.
So they've collected them, and then they've got little synopses underneath them.
Cool.
You could spend you could just say, well, I don't need TV. I'm gonna
cancel your Netflix and Hulu accounts.
Yeah,
and
just,
you're done.
Just sit there and watch documentaries all day. After a while, you probably.
You'd have too much knowledge. Would
yes,
be the
too much. Your head would explode.
Too much factual information.
You but what a cool site.
So that's documentaryaddict.com.
Documentary
Very
Addict.
Cool. Yep. All right, Ben, speaking of cool and places, tell us about some quiet places you know, would you?
One thing I like is silence, but that's another good thing to not transmit over the radio, because then people stop listening. So
I don't know if you actually can transmit silence because there's
his next story is on smell
information. But
you can transmit not very much sound.
We already covered the smell story.
Oh, he did the smell one.
So actually, yeah, silence is an interesting word because we like to imagine that silence is the absence of sound, but there never is an absence of sound, at least not practically. So even if you're in the middle of Yosemite and you can't hear anything, there is still sound there. Eventually, your ears will adjust, and you'll hear a bird, you know, cuckooing.
We have
miles
an automatic gain control built into our heads.
We do automatic gain control, and it's surprisingly hard to find software that'll do that for you for free. Anyway, so this is a map of the quietest places in America based on 1.5 million hours of acoustical monitoring. From all around the states. So, for example, some of them, they set up some acoustical monitoring on a random summer day in the Dinosaur National Monument in Utah, in New York City, just all throughout.
I love that they call it acoustic monitoring instead of a microphone.
scientific. There's a monitoring part. Yeah, sure. You know, the microphone is just a tool.
So where are they? I guess the whole map.
Yeah,
places like a Where Waldo of quietness.
Places like Yellowstone in Wyoming and the Great Sand Dunes National Park in Colorado, and various places in Nevada, kind of the west area that's not San Francisco or Silicon Valley.
Right, not the cities.
None of the cities. They have background noise levels that are lower than 20 decibels.
Oh, that's really quiet.
Which are really, really, really quiet. Actually, some researchers say that might be background noise levels that are as deep as before European colonization.
Nice.
You know what would be cool is to be able to see if the noise change, you know, like if you put a microphone in the middle of the desert and then it's a certain decibel rating, but then when it becomes night, all the crickets come out and it's like often really loud.
It
I mean, I wonder if there's a time thing in there that like...
Yeah, this is a random, the average summer day is what they were measuring.
Oh, okay. So active time.
But yeah, it's definitely hard to get acoustic space when you live in a city.
Yeah.
There's always sound going
on. That's true.
Mm-hmm. So.
All right. When the show is ending, we have like 6 minutes between our show and the show previous, which is Dr. Dawn. And Dr. Dawn's a great medical show by Dr. Dawn Motika. Hey. And she mentioned when she was leaving the frustration with technology wearing out so quickly and having to buy new stuff all the time. And Al, I thought you might want to talk about finding refurbished stuff because sometimes you can find refurbished stuff.
Oh, right.
Just previously owned, worked on again, and resold at a discount.
Yeah. This is a site. It's called refurb-tracker.com. And this site tracks Mac products.
Oh, okay.
So it's
Apple products, probably.
Yes, Apple products. And they'll send you email alerts. They have RSS feeds. And these are refurbished items that are from Apple. So they're Apple refurbished. They're not like somebody's selling their old,
right?
You know,
yeah. Basically, if you know, for Apple product, when you buy it, you actually have, I think, like a 30-day return policy, no questions asked.
Right.
They just make that. And so, what happens with those things? They've already been opened. Sometimes they're just resold again, and lots of times they don't have to refurbish anything, but they can't sell it as new because it wasn't somebody's hand. So they'll sell it as refurbished.
You got to do something with it. And if you ever bring stuff to Apple store, when you bring it back, sometimes they just swap it out.
They'll resell it here.
Yeah. And they got to do something with it. So. And I wouldn't normally bring up this kind of thing, except I went there on a whim looking at stuff. And when I looked at these prices, I was a little bit shocked.
Yeah. And lots of times you can get the same warranty from Apple for the product.
Right.
I bought the last phone that I bought, and that's the iPhone 6. We bought it at refurbed, and we saved $100, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that's obviously the way to go.
I mean,
that you're telling everybody, it's going to be harder for us to find refurbished stuff. Out.
Well, no.
So no one listened to this.
Well, the thing is, it's constantly updating every day.
Right.
So you can't be buying this every day. There's plenty for everybody. I'm looking at, there's like 407 products already right here on today's listing. And the prices are really good on like MacBooks and Mac Minis. And, you know, I'm just like, whoa.
It's not easy to say that on Mac products.
Right. And, you know, a lot of these things, they're pretty solid state, you know. And they give you the specs and everything. It's
so refurbtracker.com. You can find that from geekspeak.org, of course, as well. Thanks, Al.
Yeah.
I might have to go buy some product. I've been actually meaning to get a new laptop for my wife, so maybe that's the way I'll go. Ben, we haven't talked about security in a while. Would you mind?
Yeah, I want to segue from your vacuum cleaner eating people's hair things. Speaking of completely, completely innocuous things gone completely wrong, I'll get to that in a moment.
Okay.
First of all, I just want to say, just generally, with security, it's been a bad week. Of course, I find myself saying that every single week. It's like, God, it's been a bad week for security. I mean, so just...
We should just name a segment of the show, Bad Security Segment, you know? Anyway, what's happened this week?
Oh, it's rough, actually. So Netgear home wireless routers, a number of them have a vulnerability where unauthenticated attackers can obtain the administrator password, device serial number, and a bunch of other stuff, and like details regarding clients that are connected to it too. So potentially computers.
All right, and what to do about that, and what Netflix? I mean, what? Excuse me. Netgear brands is available at geekspeak.org. You can click and read if you've got a Netgear.
If they have something to.
If they've got a
this
fix,
is just a brief report on like
depressing.
This sucks.
We might as well just go get T-shirts made with our social securities on them.
Yeah,
and just walk around.
It's a lot easier. Right?
It's just, you know,
the whole social security number that cannot be changed, and you only get one. That is a really bad model.
Yeah.
For 2015.
I think we're finding that out.
It's also not unique. You know that? The social security number is actually reused.
Really?
People have the same number. Yeah.
What?
There's not enough of them. But let's move on.
See, actually, I was wondering about that. I was wondering about that because I was thinking, when I was in high school, I was thinking like, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 9. That's not enough.
No, there's 300 million people in the U.S., so...
And that's 100 million minus one.
Yeah, they're reused. That's okay, though, because the uniqueness is actually that plus your name.
You know what you can do?
Change your name. So you just have to find someone that has the same social security number, change your name to them, and you've broken the system. Actually, the birth date is also necessary.
We should start using symbols, like how Prince did that. We should have, like, symbols for representing us.
I agree.
And then
that would be easier for computers.
What if we could just use all of Unicode? So, like, you could be like, my social security number is... 2 happy face asterisk Apple. Anyway, so that's one. 2 is duplicate SSH keys. So there are hundreds of thousands of home routers running SSH, which is a way of remotely getting into it, with identical private and public keys. Which is really, really bad.
You had one job.
You had one job.
Oh,
right, so your public key is kind of like how you prove that you are you to the world.
Right.
Your private key is the thing that only you know. That is extremely important.
Right.
Because if anyone else knows it, then they can be you too. So there are hundreds of thousands of home routers where if you access them with SSH and you get their public key, just turn around and use that as a private key. And... You know.
Wait, I'm encrypted. You can't get into me at all. Here's a public key. And you just use that public key to get back in. It's like having the key to your house on the outside of your door. Like,
yeah,
the door is locked. It works perfectly. Here's the key.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's an imperfect metaphor, but it gets across how ludicrous this is.
All right.
So speaking of innocuous things gone horribly, horribly wrong, apparently you know what else is subject to exploits. I should just say bad security, not exploits. Car washes.
Car washes.
Car washes.
Like the great song?
Car washes seem really innocuous.
Car wash, yeah.
Right. Car washes seem really innocuous. Like they can't just get up and walk over to somebody and, you know, eat their hair or something.
Well, some of them are a little inside. Don't get out of your car inside one of these car washes. There's no telling what one of those things
did. Did you do that once, though?
No comment.
Don't go through the thing without a car.
Yeah, so these are car washes, folks.
Okay,
washing cars. Anyway, so this security researcher named Billy Rios, maybe you've heard of him, decided to try to figure out how exposed car washes because a friend who's an executive for a gas station chain that includes car washes said, oh yeah, once we had this problem where we misconfigured a car wash location remotely. And Rios is like, huh?
What do you mean?
Misconfigured it remotely, meaning you can configure car washes remotely.
Oh, so the software that runs the car wash.
The software that runs the car wash.
Was updated remotely, incorrectly.
Yes. So I guess the idea is if you run a chain of gas stations that all have car washes, you want to be able to I don't know. Upgrade them.
Sure.
Remotely.
It's just a big robot.
It makes some sense. But so apparently that mistake that that person was talking about caused the rotary arm in the car wash to smash into a minivan mid-wash, spraying water into the vehicle and at the family inside. Uh-huh. And then the minivan driver quickly accelerated out of the car wash, badly damaging the equipment and the vehicle. So,
well, that was already damaged.
It has begun.
That was a disaster because they misconfigured it, I guess. But the security researcher looked this up and tried to figure out if there were exposed automatic car washes online. And yes, indeed, there are.
No.
And you can actually get into them with just an HTTP. You can log in and shell into it with an HTTP post request.
If you have the password, or do you not need that?
There are ways.
No, no. So we have
and then you can,
online car washes that can be modified, and they can smash through windshields if
and
modified
then,
incorrectly.
Yeah, you could remote control them with
seems
an
like
HTTP
these pieces are
get
bad.
Request. You just, it's it's not hard.
Hacking so, at the car wash.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just, I have this
So
image.
Make sure someone goes in the car wash before you. That's what you're saying.
I have this, what was that movie, the hacking movie
car
from
wash?
The 80s where the people were fighting over the videotapes?
War Games?
Yeah,
war games?
No, war games? It wasn't War Games. Anyway, I've got images like that, but with car washes.
Yes,
like
battling.
With teenagers in their basements with a modem next to their computer, and they're like typing furious nonsense on a keyboard, and car washes across the United States are going mm-hmm. bonkers and
yep.
getting up and
imagine.
Uniting and
just refusing to wash SUVs.
Breaking off antennas and side mirrors.
They do that already.
Oh, they already do that. Yes. Never mind.
They got to start somewhere, Al. Yeah.
That's the robots getting people used to the idea of them damaging you. Right.
Right?
That slowly over
That's where
the
they got
years.
The idea. Hey, yeah. These things break right off.
Wow. The physical world is weak. Yeah. All right. Cool. Thanks. Well, since we're talking about robots, Al, you've got a good Kickstarter
right.
program?
Oh, yeah. There was a Kickstarter project. It was basically a personal robot. It's by Robot Base, and they met their goal very quickly.
Cool.
It's funded. And there's a bunch of, we'll have this link on GeekSpeak. There's a bunch of videos, and this thing is like, it looks like a giant spoon that's about 4 feet tall, and the round part on top has got a little video, and it's this little cartoon character woman who basically can control the things on wheels and kind of like a Roomba, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it drives around, and it you know, you say, hey, you know, it'll come into your room and wake you up in the morning. Hey, it's time to get up, you know, and it's this like cheerful face.
Can it do things like
it can do stuff like, oh, I'm going to be cooking. Can you come in here? I need to know how to make this thing. Oh, I'll give you the recipe step by step. Or
go turn on the shower for me? Like
yeah, it'll do that. It'll do what they list here is control all connected devices with your voice. Ask her about weather, news, information, sports. Tell her to play music, schedule meetings, set alarms. There's far-field voice recognition that hears you from across the room, noise canceling.
Will it stop the Roomba from attacking you? Because you could have the robots battle each other.
The relationship between this and the Roomba is between the robots. But it like can, you know, you have it at a party and it walks around and says, hey, I'm going to take a picture, get together. And it'll just move, you know, and you get together. And it
sounds extremely annoying.
It detects the face. Yeah. It detects your face okay. if you're smiling or not. No, come on, smile. You know, and it's got these little squares and they show all the demos. And,
all right. Personal robot Kickstarter program. And it met the funding, which means
it got
it's
the
be
funding.
Product.
And it's the focus is on AI. So they're saying that this is the first AI. Personal robot,
and hopefully they'll have the three laws of robotics built in.
I hope so. Yes,
yeah.
And it's a security thing. You can say, "Okay, watch the house. I'm leaving.
Call me if there's a problem."
And then it actually does watch the house for movement and goes around and looks for things moving.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So it there's all this crazy stuff. It you know it maintains the temperature in the house. It knows what you know. It you know brings the temperature up or down. You know humidity.
Awesome.
It's pretty, you know, you watch these videos and it really does look like the Jetsons, you know.
In just a second, we're going to talk more about Kickstarter. You're listening to Geek Speak. Ben, a correction.
Yeah, we have a correction. Off by one, Ares. So,
magnitude of one.
Yeah, so we were off by a factor of 10 with the number of, at least the math I did in my head, with the number of potential Social Security numbers. That is actually 999,999,999, which means that, yes, there are enough Social Security numbers for all the people in the United States. And also someone wrote in.
Yeah, so I wasn't sure about the amount of numbers when you did the math. I didn't check it. But I was pretty sure I've heard that they're reused.
Well, from
SSA.gov.
So, but
they have a billion of them, so they don't have to be reused.
Yeah, from SSA.gov, frequently asked questions are, so how many Social Security numbers have been issued since the program started in 1936? 453.7 million have been issued. And are they reused after a person died? No, we don't reassign Social Security numbers, even though we've issued 453 million so far, and we signed five and one half million new numbers per year. The current numbering system will provide us with enough new numbers for several generations in the future with no changes to the numbering system.
But it will have to be changed at some point.
Oh, yeah, but yeah. Every system would be.
Yeah, but your idea of having the number potentially have larger, like having smiley faces in it, is possible in the future, is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, then we'd have probably more Social Security numbers, potential Social Security numbers than subatomic particles in the universe. So, hey, also, darn it, I can't remember.
Well, I want you to talk about your Kickstarter for the story.
I just wanted to say it would be kind of fun to have 0000000000, and I wonder if that one has been issued.
I bet it hasn't.
If you have that and you're listening to Geek Speak, do not call in, because then we'll know your Social Security number.
Yeah. So, Ben.
Oh, yeah.
Kickstarter program.
Talking about Kickstarter.
Yeah,
so, Star Trek Continues 2015, Kirkstarter 2.0. It's their second Kirkstarter. Kickstarter.
What's a Kirkstarter?
James T. Kirk.
A Kickstarter for Kirk?
No, it's a Star Trek Kickstarter is what they're calling it. Yeah, they're calling it a Kirkstarter. Star Trek Continues, and they are trying to finish the final 2 years of the original mission. It was supposed to be a 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds, and the show was canceled after 3.
Yeah, but what are they planning to do, the same actors or different actors?
No, not the same actors. My gosh.
Okay.
But
then in
they
the
would
same
have to raise
style?
Billions
not
of
possible.
Dollars to afford it.
Not possible.
Oh,
but
yeah,
in the same
possible.
Style?
Yeah, in the same style. With replicas of the sets and actors.
Oh, that'd be kind of cool.
Yeah. Hmm. So as of last Saturday, they had met their Kickstarter of $100,000.
That's not enough to make 2 years of television.
No, but it's enough to make 2 episodes, which is what they're promising to do. And then they had a stretch goal of $150,000 that they would build an engineering set. They met that. They had a stretch goal of $175,000. They would build a set for the planet. And then they could go on away missions to the planet, and they met that.
The planet?
The planet. I don't know.
A planet.
A planet with different color sets.
Right. Yeah. They could make multiple planets just by draping sheets over different things.
All right.
But they barely did not make the stretch goal. They were 10,000 short of their 225,000 stretch goal, which would have been one more episode. So bummer on that, but kudos to them. I mean, you know, they met their stretch goal, and I'm excited to see what it's like. Production values are pretty high on it.
Sounds awesome. Thank you. So we have talked about Oculus Rift, which is, of course, a virtual reality. You totally blind yourself with a screen and get to experience things of that nature. And then, of course, Microsoft CES time talked a lot about their new thing called HoloLens, which basically is an overlay. It's an augmented reality thing where it overlays images theoretically mapped perfectly into space in the environment you're in, and therefore they lock and it looks like they're in the real environment.
So you can see like text overlays over real objects that
or
are in
3D
front of
models
you.
Floating on a table in front of you and stuff like that. Yeah. But, you know, that's just Microsoft, and Facebook actually owns Oculus Rift. So that's Facebook and Microsoft. Other people are doing this kind of stuff too, right? Al?
Yes. And it's a little bit weird. Sony has got their own smart glass now.
Oh, good.
And
oh, good. Thank goodness.
Sony always has to have what everyone else has. Yeah.
And if you look at these things, they're like these big Buddy Holly-like frames.
Nice reference.
That connect to like a pack on your waist.
Oh, I got
it. And
they
and you know, when you look at the pictures, it's called the Sony Smart Eyeglass.
Those are so ugly.
Yeah, and you know what? If you look at their advertising for it, the model wearing them, it's horrible. It's like
still
crooked.
Looks awful.
It's like they just stuck them on her face, and it doesn't even look right. They look like, oh, you just put them on. You didn't really straighten them out. They're like kind of crooked and they're big, and they're the most horrible things you've ever seen in your life. And Sony's just put all this effort behind them. It's like, I don't know, it was like right after Google Glass kind of stopped their thing, Sony jumped in and said, well, here's ours, I don't know.
Excuse me, Google has not stopped their thing. Okay, but we'll move on.
I did notice that it's running Android.
Okay. So Google still wins in this situation.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
I just don't want it to be ignored how profoundly ugly these things are.
I mean, they are terrible. And plus having to carry around a pack.
Wait, what do you mean a pack? I see a cable coming off the side of the head of the guy.
It's like a pack. He's mm-hmm. Got it up.
Yeah, it's like this little separate device.
Little puck,
this little puck that kind of hangs off the side.
But it's got a button for photographs though.
Yes.
So you can take pictures.
Oh yeah, it does a lot of the same. But at least the Google Glass was kind of not. It wasn't like right in your. I mean, you're wearing one of these things.
They look a little bit like goggles you'd swim in the water with.
Yes, that's kind of what they look
Except they are stereoscopic, so you can have two images, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Which means you can probably put objects in, and they're looks
faux
more
3D.
Like augmented reality rather than Google Glass, which is an upper left overview thing that doesn't really do augmented reality.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty friggin' nerdy, but I'd wear them. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Didn't you have a VR story?
No, I didn't. But I actually have another correction. One of our listeners is fantastic and doing all of our research for us. Area numbers beginning with 000 for Social Security numbers have never been issued.
Right. So the first set of numbers is the area.
I don't actually know.
Yeah. So from the memory that clearly is wrong already, my memory, the first three digits number or some sort of the number happens to do with the year and the location. So they were reused by location and year.
Yeah, you're right. The area numbers are assigned to geographic locations.
Commonly, siblings that are twins, for example, have similar numbers in the beginning or in the middle. I can't remember what it is.
So the first three,
and theoretically, those numbers are not very private because it's pretty easy to find out when and where someone was born, and therefore you can know if the parents use Social Security relatively quickly, you can know the first sets of them, and then lots of times people will share the last four digits, which is pseudo unique. So it's not that hard to reconstruct even if you don't know what the number
is. So like if the person was born in Arizona, that their first three are 600 to 601.
So 600 to 601.
That's the range.
Right.
If they were born in Nevada, it's 530. It's a horrible security system.
So the first set is kind of...
That's the area numbers.
The area numbers. And those change as you run out of them, of course.
The rest of them are group numbers, and they're not related to geography, but they're related to the order in which the Social Security numbers are issued in that area.
So. Right. So if you know someone that was born, near you and got the Social Security number at the same time as you, around the same area, your numbers are going to actually be really similar.
Yeah.
Which is a bad system.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the reason I did this is that when the system was invented, it wasn't computerized at all. It was paper, and they had books of these things. So you'd actually have to, you'd write them down in the local registry. So the local registry had to be able to have a unique one versus some other area. So the first three digits represented the area that you controlled. So that office, Sacramento, for example, would control a set of numbers and so on. It doesn't have to be that way anymore. We could definitely correct it. Okay, good correction. Thank you so much. Well, I think it's time to talk about what robots need, Al. Can you tell us about the future of roboting and how we can take care of them?
How we can take care of robots?
At some point, robots are going to be in control of the world, right? So we probably need some kind of long-term investment in them.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, this is kind of interesting. It's a trust fund for self-aware art-making robots.
So a self-aware art-making robot could apply for this?
It's by the Non-Human Artist Collective.
Nice.
And
the Non-Human Artist Collective.
Yes, and they seem to make – they take artwork made by robots and then they sell that art. And then the
money, proceeds of that go to the trust fund for the first self-aware artist
and
robot.
What was the movie you talked right when I said this?
Bicentennial Man.
It was Bicentennial Man.
Yeah.
And they use this money to support this whole idea of robots doing this.
The first sentient robot's going to have some money right off the bat.
Yeah.
Wow. Super intelligent.
They say
live forever and free money. Sign me up.
The programmed machinations of a nearly 30-year-old Nintendo game have been repurposed into brand new works of modern art. And are being sold with a cryptocurrency that in 1986, the year the game was released, could have scarcely have imagined.
Right.
Sure. So it's like a futuristic thing that these things are doing. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. I kind of like the idea of it. I mean, if people are into art that's made by computers, and of course, you could say at this point, because there's no sentient computers, that the person that programmed the computer and modified it to make art is the actual artist,
well,
right?
Well,
that's just the tool that did it. But
point,
at some point...
Yeah, yeah, that's what they're saying, is saying the proceeds are of this cryptocurrency that non-human members will someday own and control. So they're like holding this for when... robots can access this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a crazy thought, but it exists. You know, it's a trust fund for robots.
Trust fund for robots, specifically for art making.
Art robots.
Self-aware art making robots. Yeah. So, which is the list is short at this point.
I wonder what the legal climate will be around that. Like, let's just say a robot becomes sentient.
Yeah.
A la Bicentennial Man.
Well, we have dilemmas before they become sentient, even like the self-driving cars. You know, if the self-driving car has an accident, when it does, and it kills someone, who's actually responsible for the death? You know, that's and it's kind of, you know, well, the AI software failed, and therefore the people that wrote the software, it's tricky.
See, that's
I don't know.
But I mean, like, your anti-lock braking system fails, I mean, who's responsible? So
yeah, your car wash gets hacked and you get killed from your car wash. Who's responsible there?
Yeah,
the security people, I assume. All right. Well, we have so many more stories from Al. So, Ben, I think you're out. Do you have any more corrections? Because we've been making a lot of mistakes this
Al's
year.
That's right. I've got three more corrections. No, I'm kidding. I want to hear more about world domination, because that seems to be what you focus your stories on.
Oh, robotic world domination.
But I don't know.
Yeah,
actually,
no, sounds good.
I'll leave it up to you for what you cover next.
Well, you were interested when we were talking about Charon.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Charon.
It's this app that it's called Charon. The URL is charon.tv. And this is an app that you download. And what it does is it allows you to share unlimited file-sized files. And what it's really doing
is... Like a Dropbox kind of thing?
No. Dropbox is a cloud storage system.
Okay.
What Charon does is it lets you share a direct link between devices.
Oh, okay. So it's a point-to-point kind of sharing thing.
Right, right. And you install, and it works on phones, it's iPads or tablets. It's got apps for it's got apps for all the major platforms. But it apparently it's unlimited. You know, whatever you have on your, and you can share with up to 10 people. I'm sure there's some sort of
well, I mean, if it's a peer-to-peer thing, then yeah, I don't know how much, besides them having the software itself, you know, how
they say
would it be restricted, really?
You can send and stream between Android, iOS, PC, and Mac, and you install it, and in each one of these things, it's a little app, and you're able to just directly share. And this is actually a really big thing, because it was always a problem, you know, when you wanted to send a big file to somebody.
Yeah, like a mini gigabyte file.
Right.
You can't email it.
Emails didn't work, or their email didn't accept it, or, you know, there's all these things. But this is like an amazing thing, and it's actually not – you're not paying for storage space. It's a point-to-point connection, which is really useful. You could log in, and you can apparently share – files from your phone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
so it's kind of like a Skype thing, in the sense that you connect through them. You two people that want to share stuff connect through their service, and then after that initial handshake, then the two people transfer the file between each other. So it's kind of like a point-to-point FTP kind of thing.
Yeah, then that would make sense why the file sizes could be so big, is because then they're not paying for tons of bandwidth costs to you know, send your gigabytes and gigabytes back and forth for free.
Yeah.
I'm curious how this connects, or how this compares to BitTorrent Sync, because BitTorrent Sync does some similar kinds of things, connecting individual devices directly. It's got a bit of different kind of complexity involved.
Which one?
BitTorrent Sync.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like BitTorrent Sync. Of course, BitTorrent Sync, you could potentially use the BitTorrent protocol as well. The thing about BitTorrent Sync is they haven't actually specified how the protocol works. They haven't really given the underlying details of how it works. It uses BitTorrent kind of stuff, but it's not as open source as you'd hope. So it's a little unsure as to the security model of it. But it's definitely the same kind of concept, where you're sharing a reference. And, I mean, these kind of features, I think, are great. share on TV.tv. Sounds like a cool service. Mm-hmm. I mean, you and I use Dropbox a lot between each other.
I think Dropbox,
which of course
is
a paid service if you go a certain amount.
You get like 5 gigs free. I mean, for most people, really,
it might be all you need.
Yeah, Dropbox is an amazing service.
Definitely, but if in that situation, they store all the files. You sync all the files to them, and then everybody gets it from them. This share on service is much more about finding people that want to share a file between each other, and it's kind of like a direct connection.
Right.
It seems like one of the big things that they do is as well as enable streaming.
Yeah, exactly.
Which you can't necessarily do if you're,
So we are running short on the show, but since it's been a while, Al, do you have a crazy USB of the week this week for us?
I actually do.
Please go for it quickly.
Okay, well, you know, when you're sitting at your computer and so many people smoke cigarettes, right?
Yeah.
I think I saw somebody once smoke a cigarette. There's a USB windproof rechargeable cigarette lighter.
So full circle.
You plug this in. And it's also has a money detector function in it.
All in one USB device?
I don't know what money detector means. I
would assume false money detector.
I don't. They call it money detector. It's from Japan. That's how they do it.
That's the crazy USB of the week. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. He's used with permission. And GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So share it any way you'd like. Do anything you want with it. Just let them know we sent you. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 889 KOSP Santa Cruz, live on air at KOSP.org. That's online, of course. To find more about this episode or any episode of Geeks, go to geekspeak.org. And, of course, we're on Twitter at KOSP Geeks. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the air room is Ben Jaffe and Al Luckow. And thanks also to Chandler. And this is the episode for February 21st.